Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Great to be back in the studio with you.
Nice to be here.
When's the last time we were in the same room?
I don't know. The summer was oddly eventful.
We were traveling a lot, like, man.
Family travel, work travel, like
conventions.
I got COVID, like all kinds of stuff.
Oh, you did get COVID. That sucks. I'm shocked I don't have it after being at that DNC.
Everybody that I talked to at the DNC, like a lot of people got it.
You're seeing a lot of people be tweeting like, if I spoke to you last week, I got some bad news.
Yeah.
Speaking of the DNC, Ben, we do have to address the elephant in the room here, which are Dan Pfeiffer's comments from last week that he believes that the foreign policy section in major speeches is the best time to go pee, and that he has never listened to a word you wrote spoken by Barack Obama. How did that make you feel?
It made me feel very small. I almost felt like I could, a speech is violence. Because there's a glee in Dan's voice.
All of them.
You know?
All of them at
and
that little
just
table
all,
shitting
you know,
on us.
Turtling and... Well, first of all, I noticed that the fucking national security section went down hard, man.
Yeah.
It crushed.
We sparkled that
in
night.
The room. And like I seem to remember like Barack Obama giving hundreds of thousands of words of that I wrote for him that Dan Pfeiffer apparently was negligent in his job.
Hated him.
Because he just, maybe he didn't care about people in other parts of the world. I don't know.
I don't know, Dan.
I know who did. And now I'm going to play my trump card here. I'm going there.
Who?
Howley loved the national security section
right.
of the speeches. She would always make a point
Dan's
of saying,
better half.
Yes, Dan's better half was like a huge world, though. Proponent of that speech writing. So I don't know.
You know what, Dan? We listen. it hurts.
It hurts.
The world is listening.
The world is listening. More importantly, the world is listening.
But you know what, Ben?
No, it's all right. Dan, I will say to Dan's credit, he was a good check on the, should we have multiple paragraphs on Burma in the State of the Union address? If it was up to me, sure. So you need a Dan Pfeiffer in your life to kind of remind you of the...
Listen, yeah. If Dan was in the White House right now, we'd probably hear less about AUKUS.
Yeah.
So yes, you're right.
Dan's idea of a national security announcement on a foreign trip was, announcing that X country was going to buy X things
Boeing.
And created X amount of jobs in the U.S.
Hey.
But it was usually Boeing, yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. That's yeah. right. Listen, yeah. we were on board too. But Ben, don't look back in anger. Because Oasis is getting back together for apparently a series of concerts.
I
in the UK at least.
I'm floored by this. I was like, Oasis was like I was like all in. I mean, they were my band.
They're rock stars.
From basically the age of, I don't know, 16 to 20. I mean, it was like totally formative for me.
You met my buddy Ryan here in LA, played it with Collective Soul for a while. He's a composer.
Yeah.
He's like obsessed with Oasis. So the question I had for him is, so Oasis, it's two brothers. Famously hate each other, can't speak, broke up.
Entertainingly hate each other.
Hilariously hate each other very publicly on Twitter. So much so that they probably, left a couple $100 million on the table because they just wouldn't tour. Yeah, $1 billion on the table. Do you practice together before to get it ready for the tour? Or is there so much risk of putting those two guys in the same room that you don't let them practice?
I don't think you let them practice for a minute together. Because the number of minutes together, there's like a finite number of minutes they can be together without breaking up again. And you want to preserve as many of those concerts. And they're not that many, right? There's some scarcity here. It's like, this is not the Aerostore, but that's by design. I think they're aware of the fact they can't do like an Aerostore because they would basically kill each other by halfway through it.
Yeah. Liam Gallagher, Noel Gallagher, just, I don't know. Do what it takes. Get a Xanax prescription. Do something to get through this because I want to see this tour.
I pointed out to you that there was an Oasis during the last Labour government.
Right.
And I didn't do this. Someone did this online. And then there was no Oasis the entire Tory run.
Uh-huh.
However many fucking prime ministers that was. And now we get Labour government, we get Oasis again.
So it's hard to argue with that.
That's change I can believe in.
That is change you can believe in. So Tony Blair, Oasis.
Gordon Brown, Oasis.
Gordon Brown, Oasis.
David Cameron, that's when they broke up, right? And then, now we got Keir Starmer.
You know who I saw in Chicago briefly is Alistair Campbell, former Tony Blair aide.
The Blair guy. Yeah.
The
David Axelrod or...
Like the David
James
Axelrod
Carville
on steroids
yeah.
for Tony Blair, now the host of The Rest is Politics, who he co-hosts with Rory Stewart, who's been on the show. It's very funny. We got lunch in Chicago. Good to hang. Do a little world out time.
Yeah, I gotta do that. I want to.
Dan
do
would have hated our lunch.
Dan, you know, Dan would have sneered.
You talked about Sudan.
He would have sneered at your lunch.
Yeah,
you know? He would have come up and stood over you and said, "When are you going to talk about the middle class?"
Yeah, we're the green shoots of the economy at this lunch. Yeah, yeah.
Where is the middle class agenda at this lunch?
Okay, that felt good to get off our chest. We've both been holding it in. We got a good show today. We're going to talk about this wild arrest of the founder of Telegram. I know you've been following this closely and have some theories, some opinions.
Get some hot takes on this.
Hezbollah's long-awaited retaliation against Israel, concern of a major polio outbreak in Gaza, a huge change in U.S. nuclear policy. We're also going to talk about MPOX in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Donald Trump just riffing on foreign policy and national security in his speech.
Always good for
Monday. And then some of his former staffers made some big news. So we'll check in on people like Kash Patel and H.R. McMaster, talk about protests in India, and then why some Brits were briefly worried that Darth Vader was invading London. So stick around for that. And then, Ben, I just spoke with Vermont Senator Peter Welch. We talked about Gaza. We talked about Ukraine. And he had some very good advice for how Kamala Harris could signal that she'll do things differently on Gaza. Senator Welch has been calling for a ceasefire for nearly a year now. He's been talking about conditioning aid to Israel. He's clearly very frustrated with how things are going in Gaza, and just a principled guy with good advice. So do not miss that.
I love Peter Welch. Big fan.
Good guy. Okay, Ben, so let's start in France, where Pavel Durov, the founder of the wildly popular messaging app Telegram, was arrested this past weekend at an airport outside of Paris. Our American listeners, what do you think the Telegram usage is in the U.S.? I don't use it personally, but I know what it is.
I honestly think that it's probably people in the U.S. communicating with people in other countries.
That's what it is.
My first time using Telegram was just to talk to Russians. And when I was working on my last book, every Russian that I talked to, including Alexei Navalny, but also writers, and everybody was on Telegram. So it's ecosystem that kind of built out from Russia.
Right. You called Prigozhin just to check in.
Yeah. Prigozhin and I every now and then.
Call me after your flight.
Message each other. Yeah.
Flight ended weirdly.
Did you see this funny meme?
Yeah. So anyway, you might not have used Telegram if you're an American, but it's wildly popular outside the U.S. I think the company says it has 900 million users. Those users run the gamut from news outlets, governments, political leaders, dissidents, to just, people staying in touch with family and friends. And according to the French government, terrorists, groups like ISIS, people looking for child pornography, drug dealers, money launderers, and all kinds of bad actors. So that gets us to this little crisis here. Interestingly, French President Emmanuel Macron apparently uses Telegram on his own device all the time. It's interesting given that the arrest happened in France.
Yes.
So they detained this guy, Pavel Durov. He's not been charged with a crime by French authorities, who say he is being held as part of a broader investigation into criminal activity on Telegram, so on the platform he founded. But this arrest has pissed off a whole bunch of people, from Elon Musk to the Russian government to Russian opposition leaders. Elon and other Silicon Valley types like David Sacks claim this is a crackdown on free speech. It's the next shoe to drop after Congress voted to ban TikTok. Elon tweeted, quote, POV, it's 2030 in Europe and you're being executed for liking a meme. No hyperbole there.
Yeah.
So, Ben, Telegram is unique. It's based out of Dubai. It's one of only a few apps that is not US or Chinese based. It's very popular in Russia, where, this free speech app is, ironically, there is no freedom of speech in Russia. Ben, let's start with the sort of philosophical question or these claims by people like Elon. Do you think this is an attack on free speech? Is this a free speech issue? How are you viewing this arrest currently?
Yeah, I think it is. I don't agree that it foreshadows executions in the streets of Europe
for
in 2013
memeing.
For memeing.
What if it's a bad meme?
But, based on what the French have said thus far, they are holding a CEO accountable for content posted on his platform, not for something he posted or did.
Right.
And that inevitably hits directly at this intersection of what is the accountability, responsibility, liability for a tech company and its owner or board in some cases for what's on their platforms? And that's a really important issue. And I think there are free speech equities in that question, because the defense of these platforms is always that we're not a media company ourselves generating content; we're just a platform for it. So if you start regulating us you inherently are getting into speech questions, and I think that is objectively true. It's also objectively true that, well, why should you be able to commit crimes just because it's on a social media platform? The problem, and you know, the obvious challenge with this, and before I get to my kind of more conspiracy theory minded hot takes, is like, what? Why is Mark Zuckerberg not get arrested when he go? You know, I mean, I've seen Macron meet with Macron loves meeting with tech guys. I've seen him meet with, I think, Elon. I've seen him meet with Zuckerberg. And I'd like to know why the French government believes that Telegram is uniquely somehow different than Facebook or X. Maybe it is, and very well maybe. You know, it may be that it is a bit of a wilder west. You know, I think Facebook does go out of its way on things like child pornography. And so there is more content moderation on American platforms. I'm not trying to do a total everybody does this thing. But the question then is, like, what is the line? Like, what line is French or French authorities trying to define that has been crossed? And why is Telegram uniquely accountable in a way that a Facebook isn't? You know?
Yeah, real quickly on other companies, it has been an interesting couple of weeks for social media companies generally. I mean, you got Elon Musk in this big fight with the British government, which was blaming Twitter for inciting those far-right mobs that were in the streets and rioting after that horrible stabbing of a couple young girls at the Taylor Swift-themed dance class. This week, I think yesterday, Mark Zuckerberg sent a letter to Jim Jordan, the Republican in the House, saying that Facebook had been pressured to censor some COVID-19 content during the pandemic. He now says he would push back if that happened again. He also bent the knee by saying he would no longer donate money to help election officials prepare for elections. This was Zuckerberg's foundation with his wife. They gave like $400 million to help elections prepare to, you know, deal with voters during the pandemic. And they also said that censoring the Hunter laptop stories were a mistake. I agree with them there. But there's been all this sort of churn moving sort of in the Republican direction. Casey Newton at Platformer had an interesting piece on Telegram where he said basically Telegram's terms of service prohibit users from posting illegal pornographic content in public channels or promotion of violence in public channels, but their terms of service sort of like implicitly apply that it's fine in private communications. And that they've set up the company in such a way where they can avoid law enforcement asks, and they kind of brag about refusing to engage or help take things down or deal with, I don't know, criminal cases. So I think that's probably the material difference. It's likely like the French said, Telegram, give us X, Y, or Z, and they've refused. And they're like, all right, buddy.
Fine.
Now we got you. Now you just can't leave.
Yeah, I think, because... My own view of this, you know, is obviously there has to be some content moderation for certain, you know, illegal activity, right? But also, like, sometimes the content moderation discussion weirdly ends up lowering the bar on the tech companies, because the real problem is the algorithms, right? So the real problem is that every one of these companies has a social media platform. The algorithm is written in a way to kind of mainline anger, grievance, and allow disinformation to travel farther. That's a whole other question about the wiring of these things. In the question of, like, what are the French concerned about, you know, the one thing I was thinking was that France has been a massive target of Russian disinformation, misinformation, and just kind of negative information around the French Olympics. And the reason why is because the Russians were kicked out of the Olympics, and so they basically wanted to kind of help, you know, try to ruin the Paris Olympics.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, and so I've talked to a lot of people who kind of analyzed Russian disinformation, and you saw everything from like a fake AI Tom Cruise narrated like movie about like the corruption of the Olympics. You saw, we talked about on this podcast, remember, a lot of the anti-Ukrainian disinformation, there were bank shots into France. Like, remember that they said that Ukrainians were going to assassinate Macron.
Right.
And I wonder if the French got increasingly annoyed because a lot of the Russian disinformation.
Did they do the opening ceremony? Were they that blue guy?
I don't know who the blue guy was, but a lot of the Russian disinformation in recent years, what the Russian government does and the Russian kind of troll farms do is it starts on Telegram. So they, the first, and Wagner Group does this too, like the first shit they post, and it's kind of funny because the Navalny people also like post on Telegram, right? So it's open to everybody, but the Russians will get something kind of going on Telegram, see, get it some traction, and then it kind of jumps over into, you know, Meta, WhatsApp, X, et cetera. And so I am curious, you know, if some of the French government's motivation is they've kind of been the target of a lot of crap on Telegram in the last year or two. But also, like, if they start pulling the thread, like the relationship, what's the relationship between the Russian government and Telegram?
Yeah.
You know, like there's all, this becomes one of those massive legal things. Like, there's a lot we could, you know, maybe learn, whether you agree with the detention or not. And I have a lot of reservations about it because, you know, it just feels pretty dramatic without a lot of explanation. But we could try to understand that better, too.
Well, that's an interesting point. So this guy, Pavel Durov, he's an interesting character slash kind of like peak Silicon Valley bro.
Yeah.
He's 39 years old. He's reportedly worth over $9 billion. Before Telegram, he founded a company called VK, which is basically like a kind of Russian clone of Facebook. He fled Russia for Dubai in 2014 after being pressured to hand over data to the Russian government or shut down pages of opposition leaders. So he wound up in Dubai. But he loves to like post photos of himself shirtless on Instagram, looking admittedly pretty shredded. Good for you, pal. he also claims to have fathered more than 100 kids because he's a sperm donor.
Oh, so he's got the Elon Musk populate the world.
Yeah, thing. He says his women want his, quote, high-quality genes. Is what he says. So he's in the Elon Musk thing where he's like worried about the declining birth rate and happy to help out.
Yeah.
It's kind of like they always dabble in some light eugenics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And world domination.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And if you read Walter Isaacson's book, there's a lot in there about how Elon thinks his father being a bad guy screwed him up. There's less thinking about whether having a bunch of kids and then abandoning them might screw them up too. Yeah. But we digress. So when this comes out, Ben, they will either have, the French will have to have charged Durov with a crime or released him based on their law. They have to release him on Wednesday. It's Tuesday right now. So we'll know more. But there is the question you raised just now is, what is the relationship between Telegram and the Russian government? Because if they didn't find Telegram useful in some way, the Russian government would shut it down, but it's all over the place. And the question is why? Oh, and one other thing before we get to that question, here's a clip of Pavel Durov talking with Tucker Carlson on his show about sort of his concern about government and authority.
So one of the things we learned when Elon Musk bought Twitter is that the intel agencies, not just US, but a bunch of other countries, the usual suspects, were all over the company. I mean, some of them were present working at the company. They had access to the direct messages. You can just imagine, well, you know, because you run one, but the wealth of data flowing through would be of great interest to governments. Does that make you paranoid that you'll be penetrated? I mean, I assume governments would like to know what's going on sort of privately on Telegram.
Well, there's definitely a lot of responsibility that we have on our shoulders. And I wouldn't say we are paranoid, but I think it makes sense to stay prudent and you know, not being too accessible, not traveling to weird places.
You don't travel to weird places?
I hope not. Like, I travel to places where I have confidence that, you know, those places are consistent with what we do and our values. I don't go to any of the big geopolitical powers of the countries like China or Russia or even the U.S. So
you don't go to the U.S.?
I try not to. I can go, but, you know, it's too much attention, like I described before.
Travel risk analysis was a touch off.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to this question of the connection with Russia. What do you think?
I think it's the most interesting question at the heart of all this. And look, I don't know what he might have, you know, the question of what kind of personal contacts or communications he's had with the Russian government. You know, he's also clearly feels paranoid about them. So I'm not suggesting, you know, he's like in Putin's inner circle in any way. He's been an antagonist. He's had to leave the country. But what's interesting is, what does the Russian government get out of the existence of Telegram? Because it wouldn't exist if they didn't want it to. You know, if they wanted to shut down Telegram in Russia, they would have shut down a long time ago. And I think they get a couple things out of it. Like I said, they clearly get to use it as a kind of laboratory to test out their information campaigns and see how they get traction, to get attraction. And you know, I'm sure the Telegram knows about that and clearly does nothing about that. And but then also the Ukrainians use Telegram, the Navalny operation use Telegram, and on the one end, that's good for them that they have these platforms, and that's why you saw like Alexei Navalny's chief of staff, Leonid Volkov, who's been on this podcast, he came out in support of Pavel Bure yesterday. But it's also useful for the Russians to be able to monitor all that, you know, and not in, I mean, it sounds strange to say, not even in like some extrajudicial way, but just there's an information ecosystem they can watch and manipulate that is closer to home, right? It's probably in an easier information set for them to get their arms around, in some cases even than foreign run platforms. And so, you know, what I find it almost hard to believe there's no interaction between the Russian government and people at Telegram. But we don't know. But if you start pulling the thread, if this becomes, turns into some major litigation, we might learn something, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. Also, you said, Pavel Bure there.
Oh, sorry.
look, amazing hockey player.
Yeah. Wait.
Nicknamed the Russian Rocket.
Keep this in because it does date me, as when I was following hockey.
Yeah. You know? He's 53.
Yeah. Exactly.
So he was dates on me. A Canuck. He was
when
really
I was
good
like
in
a
like
kid,
NHLPA 94,
95. Dude,
Sega Genesis.
This is why.
Yeah.
Because I was obsessed with that video game,
Jeremy
and
Roenick.
He had the classic, you know, you could come down and give the, like the one pass to the middle, boom.
One-timer.
Because he was Pavel Bure was a fast one-timer.
So fast.
Get in there right next to the goal, boom, you know.
Great hockey player.
All right, sorry.
Total stud, too.
Good correction.
How do we pivot to Israel? Let's just do it. Let's turn to Israel, Ben, where for weeks they have been waiting to see what Hezbollah was going to do. And maybe even Iran, in response to Israel's assassination of a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut several weeks ago now, right? Was it last month? I don't even remember.
Time is like years or in weeks.
Three presidential candidates
ago. Yeah.
On Sunday, the response—
Pre-Tim Walz.
Pre-Tim Walz, yeah. That finally happened. So this was Sunday. The back and forth started with Israel sending 100 warplanes into the air to launch preemptive strikes on what the IDF described as 40 Hezbollah rocket launch sites. Hezbollah says they launched 340 rockets at military sites in Israel, though it seems like those strikes did very little damage because of the preemptive Israeli action and their missile defense systems, which are very effective. Normally, with these kinds of rocket attacks, Hezbollah targets northern Israel, but this time they fired at sites in central Israel. So they're extending their range, specifically at a military base that serves as the headquarters of Unit 8200, which does signals intelligence for the IDF. It's basically like the Israeli military's version of our NSA. An Israeli sailor was killed by shrapnel from an air defense interceptor missile, but that's the only casualty I've read about. So, Ben, I mean, once again, you have these like major escalations. You have very effective missile defense systems limiting the damage, limiting the casualties. Now both sides do seem to want to de-escalate, which is good, but we're still like at a place where there's no progress in ceasefire talks. There's no, you know, nothing's going well in Gaza, nothing that would end the fighting and get Hezbollah or the Houthi rebels in Yemen to stand down for good. And so I worry we're getting numb or used to the risk of these massive escalations that would have been historic,
yeah,
you know, a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, it was striking that both what Hezbollah wanted to do and what they did and what Israel did, you could feel it being within this kind of containment paradigm, you know, like it felt like everybody wanted to make clear that this is another short-term exchange of fire, not the mm-hmm. beginning of something new. And Hezbollah wanted to send enough rockets that it didn't feel like a normal rocket attack, but not so many rockets that, you know, Lebanon gets invaded by Israel. And Israel wanted to, you know, do enough damage to Hezbollah to diminish their capacity to hit, but they're not really setting back Hezbollah, right, like comprehensively, right? So it's just all in this kind of strange calibration, the kind of the insanity of war, you know, like how much, you know, how many rockets do we have to fire for it to be credible, and how many rockets do we have to blow up from Israel? Look, you summed it up well. I mean, what I take away from this is Israel has this kind of tactical advantage on both Hezbollah and Iran, you know, because of their missile defense systems principally, and because of some of their, you know, offensive capabilities.
And intel. Clearly, they like knew this was coming.
And they're deep into, they clearly deeply penetrated, you know, Lebanon. They have an ability to kind of punch Hezbollah or Iran harder than Hezbollah and Iran punched back. But at the same time, that tactical military advantage doesn't add up to some large strategic advantage for Israel.
Yeah, good point.
Because it's still got Gaza. It's still internationally isolated. It's still got, you know, is whole populations of towns in northern Israel have been have been
150,000 people
removed,
displaced on both
displaced,
sides.
Displaced, basically.
Kids are missing school.
So
communities are never going to return to what they were.
You know, this allows Bibi to kind of look like, you know, he's this guy swinging some punches at everybody, at Hamas, at Hezbollah, at Iran. And yet, can we say that Israel today, that this is all adding up to making Israel, like, safer, more secure, more successful? No, you know? So it's a kind of strange dynamic where I don't see their advantage leading to some outcome. And as long as Gaza is going on, we're just kind of, like you said, peculiarly living with this tinderbox catching on fire, and we just hope it doesn't blow up, you know?
And to your point on things not changing in Gaza, I mean, there's some important updates. I mean, the IDF rescued a 52-year-old Israeli airman from a tunnel in southern Gaza today, Tuesday. That's a great thing. This is the only 8th hostage rescued alive since the war started. The IDF seems to have found him by chance as they were looking for Hamas fighters. His name is Farhan Al-Qadi. He'd been working as a security guard on the Israeli kibbutz near the border when he was captured. So that's obviously amazing. However, the doctors have now confirmed the first case of polio in Gaza. A 10-month-old child caught the disease and is now paralyzed in one leg. So a bunch of health organizations are desperately trying to put together a vaccination program. They got 1.2 million vaccine doses arrived in Gaza on Monday, but distributing them in an active war zone where you don't know where anyone is. I mean, normally you just go house to house to house and you give them one dose and 3 weeks later you give them the second. Like, I don't know how you do this in IDP camps where people are getting pushed around all the time. And that's why you see a lot of these medical groups are calling for basically a temporary vaccine ceasefire to do this work. UNICEF says at least 95% of kids in Gaza need to get 2 doses of the polio vaccine to prevent them catching and spreading the disease. If an outbreak occurs, it'll almost certainly spread outside of Gaza and into Israel. So it's a disaster. So Ben, you know, again, like the other part about this, like everything's worse.
Yeah.
And then you read about the current talks and you read these quotes or you listen to international news and the only ones expressing optimism are American officials and everyone else, yeah. Hamas,
really just
Qatar,
really just Tony Blinken and John Kirby too.
Yeah, like, it's just like good down there. There's just like happy talk. Joe Biden.
Well, and Joe Biden. Joe Biden.
Predicting. I guess.
How many times Joe Biden come out and said we're just about to get ceasefire done?
Ramadan, yeah. A couple weeks
ago.
Ice
cream, NATO summit.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. Like, why do we think that's happening? Why is there so much optimism but no policy change? Do you think?
I'll give you a less cynical answer and then the cynical answer, right? The less cynical answer is that they're working really hard. They have to look like there's progress because they want to keep the pressure on the parties. And, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, who are exhausting every effort. The cynical answer is, if it looks like there's a process, it's less of like a news story in some way.
That's
like,
true.
That basically it's like, we have an answer to the question of what are you doing about Gaza? And when you're essentially not doing anything in terms of exerting leverage on the Israelis, the only thing you can be doing is trying to get a ceasefire. And this is kind of the cynical truth is it's kind of worked. Gaza's kind of off the front page. Every incoming question is answered with, well, we're working really hard and we're optimistic about the ceasefire. And then there's these efforts to blame Hamas for everything, even though we increasingly have learned that, you know, usually these things, you know, Bibi comes in and changes the terms. And I think it's really, really frustrating because it's just hard to take seriously at this point, you know, when you kind of keep having the same meetings. And meanwhile, you mentioned polio. Part of what people are missing here is that this may not be on the front page, but it is, it's not like it's any better. It's worse in Gaza than it was a month ago, 2 months ago, three months ago.
Yeah.
And this is not like, I actually don't like how much there's been a focus on the ceasefire, because even if there is a ceasefire, all of Gaza is completely destroyed. Probably many more than 40,000 people have been killed. But then how many people are amputees? How many people are orphans? How many polio, malnutrition? like this entire population is being like pulverized in ways that they will deal with for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
There's not a single person in Gaza who's not been deeply traumatized and touched by their house got blown up, their parents got killed, they got wounded, they have polio, they're at malnutrition. And that's not going to go away because there's a ceasefire.
Like the Gaza Strip is unlivable.
Yeah. And so
there's no sanitation, there's no infrastructure, there's no water.
And this whole conversation becomes, it's an easier story to cover. You know, like I, as someone who like, you know, listens to you know, Up First on NPR in the morning, you know, it reads
Qatar,
New York Times.
Yeah.
It's easier to be, exactly. Like there are another round of talks in Qatar and the Egyptians said this and the Americans said that, but the Israelis said that. And, you know, Brock Ravid, Siren on Twitter, like there's going to be another round of talks. That's like an easier story to tell than the story of like what's actually happening in Gaza, you know, or the question about, well, after there's a ceasefire, then what happens in Gaza? And so this whole thing has peculiarly become about these talks and not about like what is actually happening.
Yeah, that's a really good point because that's the hard part for Kamala Harris. I mean, we might get a ceasefire, we might end the war, but the long-term challenge
is immense.
If she
gets elected, Gaza is going to be as big a challenge the next day, even if there's a ceasefire in place.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Real quick before we go to break, we are just very, very excited to announce that the trailer for Crooked's newest limited series, Empire City, is here and available for you to listen to. It's from Wondery, Crooked Media, and Push Black. Empire City is the untold origin story of the NYPD. It uncovers the hidden history of one of the largest police forces in the world. It is from Peabody Award-winning host Chenjerai Kamanika. He is an incredible host. You might have listened to some of his past shows, like Uncivil. And he takes you on this amazing journey through pivotal moments in New York's past that formed the foundation for today's policing. From its origins rooted in slavery to rival police gangs battling across the city, from the everyday people who try to resist this organization every step along the way. You should check out Empire City. It's an amazing show. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and listen everywhere to the full show on September 9th. And you can listen ad-free on Wondery Plus, which you can join in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Also, Ben, we set this big goal at the DNC. We're trying to sort of harness the enthusiasm, get people pumped up, get people to turn out and volunteer for Election Day.
My dad volunteered.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Please tell your dad thank you.
My dad, like, is crushing it.
God bless that man. So we set a goal of 75,000 volunteers by September 17th. We are getting there, but we're not there yet. If you've never volunteered before, use Vote Save America's website. We'll help you find opportunities that are tailored to you. If you want to do just one time, one off, we'll get you. If you want to, you know, volunteer every weekend from now until Election Day, we'll help you find that too. Go now. Help us hit that 75,000 goal. Go to votesaveamerica.com/2024. That's votesaveamerica.com/2024. Be like Ben's dad. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. All right, Ben, after that that quick break, faster than a Pavel Bure.
Yeah, one-timer. if you can get your hands on NHL PA 94, those one-timers are just, you can't defend against it.
I love that game.
Yeah.
I love that game. Everything I know about hockey is from that game. Speaking, how the fuck do I pivot to this? Well, if you thought that conversation about Gaza was a bummer, how about this one about nukes? So one kind of under-discussed, these guys are going to fucking shoot me for doing such a bad job selling the show. Okay, Ben, speaking of one-timers, let's talk about nuclear weapons.
I got one for you. But while Pavel Bure may be the focus of this conversation, it's no longer just Russia that's the focus of American nuclear weapons policy.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So big picture, Ben, we're keeping all this in. You and I talked about this, but I think an under-discussed sort of tragedy of the Trump era was the death of arms control.
Yes, pretty big fucking deal.
Pulled out of the Iran deal. They pulled out of the INF treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The Trump people gave up on efforts to extend the New START treaty, which was like the only remaining treaty in the world that limited the number of deployed nuclear weapons between the U.S. and Russia. So Biden gets in, he extends New START. That was a good thing. But more recently, The entire arms control paradigm has shifted because of China and their rapid development of nuclear weapons, which gets us to last week. So the New York Times reports that the U.S. has reoriented its entire nuclear deterrence strategy to take China into account. Officials are worried that on the current path, China could end up with about the same number of deployed nuclear weapons as the U.S. and about the same number of intercontinental ballistic missiles by, like, you know, 2030. So very bad news. And then there was a quote from a top arms control official on Biden's NSC who said, quote, "Absent a change in the trajectory of adversary arsenals, we may reach a point in the coming years where an increase from current deployed numbers is required. In other words, we will start to reverse the progress made by New START in arms control treaties in decades of work from Ronald Reagan until now." So, Ben, this is complicated because China reportedly refuses to engage on arms control talks until they feel like they have achieved some parity. I don't know if that's true. That's what I've read. I saw Jake Sullivan, I think, is in China now meeting with their national security advisor. So maybe this is coming up. So we'll see. But I'm just curious, like, given how much time we spent on arms control and New START and how this is such a priority for President Obama, I mean, how significant do you think these reports and quotes are about the U.S. reorienting towards China and potentially talking about producing more nukes?
It's super alarming. And I mean, first of all, the background is that, you know, China's long had a nuclear weapons arsenal, but the perception was it was a kind of a minimalist arsenal. They had just enough to make people back off. You know, we have enough nuclear weapons essentially to blow you up. So don't think about taking a shot at us.
Like the French, like a couple hundred.
Yeah, which, by the way, is like, I've never fully understood why we need, unless we literally think we're going to fight and win a nuclear war, why we need, you know, tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. So China's had this nuclear arsenal, but they never, you know, even the Obama years, we tried to kind of begin to multilateralize arms control, bring them into conversations. And the Chinese have been fairly resistant to joining arms control talks beyond, you know, they're in the non-proliferation treaty. They're signatories to all the kind of, you know, major pieces of the origins of arms control. That said, you're right. Like, there is no arms control anymore, right? And the U.S. is as, if not more, responsible for that than anybody else, you know, between George W. Bush and Trump just tearing up a whole bunch of agreements. I don't understand why this isn't a bigger deal.
I know.
I'm here, like, to be for the arms control geeks out there. You know, we lived through the Cold War, and, like, people on both sides decided, hey, we can't live without a lot of arms control.
This is crazy.
You know, dating back to John F. Kennedy,
yeah,
after the Cuban Missile Crisis, like, wait a second, and Kennedy calls for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, right, banning on nuclear weapons testing. And then ever since then, like, Nixon had detente, and they had the SALT Treaty, and then fucking Ronald Reagan almost agreed to destroy all nuclear weapons with Gorbachev, bans intermediate range nuclear weapons, you know, deep cuts after the Cold War. Obama builds on this. And this was the biggest issue. Like, when I had COVID, one of the things I did is I watched, like, the Day After, that 80s movie about, like, what happens in a nuclear war. 100 million Americans
Damn,
watched this movie.
You were in a dark place, huh?
I was in a pretty dark place.
Sorry.
I'm writing about Reagan and arms control. So I genuinely think that this needs to be a much bigger concern, because we now have three countries, the United States, Russia, and China, that have, like, removed guardrails from their nuclear modernization, and they're building their nuclear arsenals without an arms control framework around it.
Right.
You know, and this is, I think, what's important for people to understand is, like, part of what arms control does is, yeah, try to keep the numbers down of the weapons, but it also, it's like, you can't deploy certain range missiles that basically you can't be trying to win a nuclear war in what you're doing. You know, you want to have a kind of parity that everybody can chill out. And I'm really worried. One, it's just costly as hell. Like, it's going to cost trillions of dollars if the U.S. starts to feel like we're back in a nuclear arms race. We already are spending too much on this. But also, it's just dangerous as hell. Like, to think that we can have... Why was it, you know, why in the Cold War were we like, yeah, it's not okay, we need to sit down and have all these treaties, but we feel better today with like Putin and Xi Jinping and fucking Donald Trump in this country. Like, let's get some treaties around this stuff. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing when it's two countries trying to achieve parity. When you throw a third in there, it gets incredibly complicated. I mean, we've all watched half of one episode of The Three Body Problem and then gave up on it.
Yeah.
You know, we get it.
Well, with the North Korea sitting there and the Iranians are on the doorstep and the Israelis have, you know.
Right.
I mean, this is a mess. And because it's hard and, yeah, the Chinese are resistant, I don't think that's enough of an answer. I think, you know, you have to just try to insist that arms control is going to be on the agenda. And by definition, arms control is something you do with adversaries. We don't need to negotiate agreements with the French and British about nuclear weapons. We just fucking do it with the Chinese and the Russians. So yeah. I hope that if Kamala Harris wins, and Biden has begun to, you know, they begin to link AI too, because like, you don't want the AI in charge of the nuclear weapons.
No.
What if the robots decide to kill us all? So like, I think the next president, hopefully Kamala Harris, this is an area that, you know, sneaky could be a major push, or I would encourage it to be.
Yeah, I hope so. And also Alona flags that we screwed up by not saying, speaking of Russian rockets, to get us from Pavel Bure into the arms
control
section.
Well, that's what happens when we have Russian,
That's good.
Yeah, like
that's
someone
really
who's,
good.
That's really good.
That's A+.
Really that's A+.
A+. Speaking of less A+ topics, on Monday, the World Health Organization's plan.
These transitions are so good. We have to keep everyone in.
Some of my worst ever. So on Monday, the WHO, they launched a plan to address Mpox, which they declared a public health emergency of international concern a couple weeks ago. This outbreak is centered around the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there have been 23,000 total cases of the disease. That's up from 19,000 total last week. Mpox is beginning to pop up in other countries in Africa. It's been seen in Thailand, Pakistan, Sweden, a bunch of other places. So this variant that's now spreading is different than the 2022 outbreak, where there was 100,000 cases worldwide. That outbreak primarily affected men through sexual contact, while the current outbreak in the DRC is hitting children really hard. The majority of the cases are children, which is just awful. You're just listening to NPR yesterday, and there was a woman whose all five of her kids got it. You know, two hadn't recovered yet, so it's just devastating. It has also been very difficult to get vaccines to where they needed. Some people have criticized the WHO's response as slow, hobbled by red tape. Germany is donating 100,000 vaccines from its stock, but that is a drop in the bucket when the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have estimated that 10 million doses are needed to stop the current outbreak. We spoke to Anne Ramoyne, an epidemiologist at UCLA who's been studying Mpox for more than two decades, to get some more context.
This Mpox outbreak has been ongoing in DRC for decades. And in the last several years, it's really accelerated. And there have been a lot of questions why. The idea that this is the WHO's sole responsibility to be able to take this in hand and to be able to do something, I think is a little bit misguided. I mean, WHO provides advice and provides, you know, some leadership, but WHO isn't responsible for funding response activities. WHO is not responsible for you know, being able to fund vaccines. There's shared responsibility in all of this, and it's complicated to be able to get the appropriate response and to be able to get the vaccines that are needed, get them through regulatory approvals in DRC, and then start to think about what happens next. And those vaccines have to actually get to the people that need it. And that requires logistics, that requires a plan for social mobilization and sensitizing people, a plan to be able to get not only to rural, remote areas where we're having the vast majority of cases in children, but also in vulnerable populations, sometimes hidden populations, people who do sex work, men who have sex with men in low resource settings.
So, you know, Ben, I'm far from an expert on this. I mean, it did remind me of like the conversations we were having in 2021 when they were rolling out the COVID vaccines about vaccine equity and the fact that the continent of Africa just got, you know, completely screwed over. That is clearly happening again here because, you know, when there's an Mpox outbreak in the U.S., vaccines pour into New York or, you know, there are other major cities, and it's not happening in the DRC. Obviously, the distribution is a lot harder in a place like the DRC, given the size and the lack of infrastructure. But, you know, the people across Africa are furious, especially doctors and epidemiologists.
Yeah, it reminds me also a bit of Ebola in the sense that, you know, that's started in West Africa, and part of what is missing is like a evolved public health supply chains and capacity to surge resources. In that case, it was less, you know, vaccines and more public health workers, public health infrastructure, like hygiene. And the U.S. military basically ended up building some of that infrastructure. And that gets to the point that she made that's so smart, which is sometimes when these outbreaks happen, you know, the default response is, oh, the pencil necks and paper pushers down at the WHO, they're not moving fast enough, you know. And yes, there is a lot of red tape. But the reality is, again, the WHO is not like building, you know, logistics hubs and flying in vaccines. They're just like making reports and warning people of things. And that ultimately, there's no solution to these kinds of problems that don't involve a dramatic increase in capacity closer to where these outbreaks are happening, even in places like the DRC that don't have much of a healthcare infrastructure. And it shows the importance of trying to help them build healthcare infrastructure, not just when there's like a crisis like this, but, you know, consistently. And the only other thing that I take away from this, you know, hopefully that people get their arms around this and they surge more resources at it. But are you feeling good, Tommy, about like the next pandemic? If we've got like anti-vax movements all over the world and people hate the WHO and they think, you know, there's lab leak people and people that, you know, like...
We feel worse off.
We have the worst... We are less prepared. Right. You'd like to think you learned the lessons from the last, you know, pandemic, so you're ready for the next one. I worry that actually it's the opposite.
I feel the same way. It's like, on the one hand, I'm really glad we all know what mRNA vaccines are and we can make them. But on the other hand, it's like the politics have shifted against it. The anti-vaxxers are ascendant. None of these countries seem to have invested in infrastructure. It's bad.
Yeah, it's bad.
Bad news. Doesn't make you feel good. Well, Ben, one of the reasons we are less prepared for the next pandemic is Donald Trump. So let's talk about him for a minute. So Donald Trump gave a speech on Monday. There was a National Guard convention in Detroit, Michigan. He gave this long speech. It was like half prompter, half riffing, as he likes to do. A couple policy things that he tried to roll out or that he mentioned that jumped out at me, assuming they were intentional. Trump is now calling on NATO countries to spend at least 3% of GDP on defense, which is an increase from the 2% target. So that is a thing. He also floated creating a National Guard for the Space Force, which I just kind Wait, of...
I admit to not having seen that. Just hearing you say that out loud, I get a
bunch of weekend astronauts.
Is it like Elon Musk? Or like,
you know, I have no idea. I just thought it was really funny, too. I laughed out loud. Mostly the speech was a chance to attack Biden over the Afghanistan withdrawal around the three-year anniversary in an effort to sell himself as the guy that will keep America out of wars, including in the intro from Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat who left the Democratic Party and is now endorsing Trump. Let's take a listen to a selection of Trump's speech.
Before I even arrive at the Oval Office, shortly after I win the presidency, I will have the horrible war between Russia and Ukraine settled. I'll get it settled very fast. I don't want you guys going over there. I don't want you going over there. And I'm the only candidate in this race who can make this promise. I will prevent, this is for the spouses, I will prevent World War III. Nobody else is going to prevent it. You're going to end up in World War III. Look at what's going on right now with Ukraine. They're surging into Russia, okay? You're going to end up in World War III, and it's going to be a bad one.
As opposed to the good one.
There's good World War III. So, look, I don't know. It's a very blunt, simple message. But I wonder, I mean, given that people turn on the TV and they see Gaza being scary and wars raging in Ukraine, and then, you know, you see the same polling and focus groups I do where, you know, when you ask people, like, should we be sending money to Ukraine for weapons or investing in schools? Like, the answer is unanimous in one direction. So I worry about this message a bit, if he sticks to it.
Yeah, no, I think that people have to realize that he's hitting a nerve that has pretty broad support in the United States. And look, even you and I were talking, like, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard are kind of these kooks. You know, he, like, what, decapitated a whale now and put it on the car, and she's a conspiracy theorist. But from the outside, you know, he's a Kennedy. She's a former congresswoman. Like, these are well, you know, some, you know, he has very high name ID. Kennedy does. I would take seriously the idea that, like, he's got this coalition that includes you know, people that don't like foreign wars, don't like foreign entanglements, don't like foreign assistance, don't like trade agreements, don't like globalization, that crosses both parties,
yes.
You know? And so you have to kind of take this seriously and, you know, counter actually that, you know, Trump is actually more likely to get us into wars because he's erratic, because he's unstable, because our alliances help keep us out of wars. You know, like we have to be defending things like NATO on the basis that they help prevent war, and rather than just kind of making them seem like it's warlike and we want to be in Ukraine forever, mm-hmm. like, you know, pouring weapons in there, which is the trap that Democrats and even, you know, a lot of Republicans that don't like Trump fall into. So that's the thing I'd say is like he sounds like ridiculous, but there's a potency to his message, and I think bipartisan support out there for it. And so the framing, you know, around how Kamala and Democrats present their support for alliances and kind of certain aspects of the global order has to be about this is actually a better way to keep us out of wars and a better way to minimize like what has been an overreach in our foreign policy.
Yeah. The other thing in the news recently that is concerning is just more stories about Trump's staff, former staff, and maybe future staff. There's two pieces worth highlighting. So one was an Atlantic story about this creep named Kash Patel. We've talked about him on this show before. He served in a few roles in the Trump administration. He was on the NSC as a counterterrorism director or something. Then he kind of ass-kissed and failed his way up to becoming acting chief of staff at the Pentagon. A few things that are worth knowing
after
about this guy.
After being deputy to Rick Grinnell at DNI.
At DNI, yeah. Yes. He worked in the DNI's office. Yeah. So Kash Patel is now, I think, trying to set himself up to become CIA director or the DNI. He's doing that by selling lots of merch with his branding on it, including scarves, golf polos, and wine. You can buy Kash Patel branded wine for $239 for six bottles. He wrote a children's book about Trump called The Plot Against the King. It tells the story of a wizard named Kash who set out to save King Donald from the sinister machinations of Hillary Queenton and a shifty knight. That's Adam Schiff.
Wait, you see what he did there? Yeah, okay,
reference,
you saw what he
yeah.
did there.
Some Trump advisors quoted in the piece say that Kash Patel now claims that he gave the order to take out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the ISIS chief, in 2019, although he apparently wasn't even in the room. And then this is actually really concerning, Ben. So The Atlantic recounts this story from October 30th, 2020. So it's right before the election. SEAL Team 6 is waiting for authorization to conduct a rescue operation to save an American who had been kidnapped in Western Africa. The last holdup before they launch this operation is getting the permission to fly in Nigerian airspace. That job goes to the State Department. According to this story, Kash Patel calls the Pentagon. He says, "I got approval from then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Launch the operation." So these Navy SEALs are in the air. They're like waiting to land when they figure out, actually, we did not get authorization to go in Nigerian airspace. So they have to circle until someone else finally fixes the problem. But basically what happens is Kash Patel just made up that he got authorization to do this from Mike Pompeo and almost sent a bunch of Navy SEALs into Nigerian airspace without permission, where they could have been shot down by like Nigerian air defenses or viewed as hostile. So like it's just an insane thing to do.
Biggest country in Africa, like a, you know,
real military, probably has American air defense systems that could have shot at them. So again, everyone thinks this guy could be the CIA director or the DNI. It's like just a great window into the very scary, the worst of the worst, like scary hacks who would serve in this guy's foreign policy team.
Yeah, he's a total nutcase. I mean, this isn't the case of someone with like a different ideological point of view. This is someone who's just totally pilled, you know. I mean, I crossed paths with him when he was Devin Nunes's like hatchet man on the House Intelligence Committee investigating, you know, the Russia interference, but from the Trump perspective, mm-hmm. you know. So he kind of, but like he was just conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory. That's all he was doing. And so he's like, to be clear, Project 2025, the Trump administration 2.0, it will just be Kash Patels.
Yeah.
You know, like that's, those are the people that will staff the government. They are totally ideological. This is a guy that like reveres Donald Trump more than any idea, will do whatever the thing is he wants, will be totally unaccountable to protocols, to guardrails, to constraints, to reality itself, like whether or not the Nigerians had given that approval. And just because he's buffoonish, you know, and writes children's books about King Kash helping the wizard Donald, doesn't mean it's not just dangerous as hell that that's the case. And by the way, like he'd never be confirmed for those jobs, I think, even if there was a Republican Senate. But it doesn't matter because I don't think Trump people give a shit. These acting people, they'll just keep acting. You know,
for years.
They could be acting head of the CIA for years and make life so miserable. And this is what Project 2025 kind of winks at. If you get the ideologues on top, they'll just make life so fucking miserable for the workforce that they'll leave and they'll be replaced by other Kash Patels.
Yeah. The other weird kind of former Trump staffer news was from a guy named H.R. McMaster. Listeners might remember him. He's a decorated military leader who was very well respected, lieutenant general, who became Trump's national security advisor from 2017 through 2018. He has a new book out where he like celebrates some Trump policy, takes some shots at him in familiar territory. But Ben, in talking to you before we did this, I didn't realize this was the second book, the second memoir about his time in the Trump administration?
Yeah. So he wrote a book called Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World.
Okay.
You know, not like this guy has any grandiose sense of his own. And I actually wrote a review for the Washington Post about that book. Now that when I look at the headline, and which, by the way, covers his time in the Trump administration. It's all about like how they finally got tough on China. Mm-hmm. And they finally saw the threat from Iran, takes all these shots at Obama, I remember. The title of my review is McMaster's memoir is heavy on history but light on Trump. Well, now we know why, because you needed to monetize, you know, the surface twice, right? And he's waited 4 years and done another memoir, I guess, to share some things with us. You know, it just shows you how absurd all these. Like, if H.R. McMaster was that, look, I'm glad this is happening. I hope they all come out. I hope all the older white guys, John Kelly, you know, Rex Tillerson, share all your best Trump stories, endorse Kamala Harris. Please do it. But there's something pretty absurd about this guy. If he was that concerned about Trump, you could have resigned at the time. You could have told people at the time. You could have told people in 2020 before the election. Instead, this stuff kind of dribbles out and background quotes to like Jeff Goldberg and then, you know, in The Atlantic. And then, you know, write one book and you kind of turn the dial a little bit. And then you see like, I need to get some attention. So this time I'm going to take a whack at Trump and I'll get me booked on all the Sunday shows. And there's something grotesque about like some of these Trump people. Like, I have more respect for the ones that have just gone all in, right? You know, like Olivia Troy, mm-hmm. like she's just owning it, right? There's this kind of incrementalism that I find really frustrating with these guys.
Two books about the same period of time. Yeah. I've never heard of it. you should write another memoir.
Well, at least about I got some shit from some. My second book is, it's not a memoir. It's about the rise of authoritarianism, but it has like some first person thread. So a couple of friends of mine are like, oh, look at you. You had to. Well, I was like, at least I picked up the thread in 2017. Like, I didn't. You know, like,
cover the same ground.
Yeah, come on.
That's
guys.
Crazy. Okay, two more things before we get to the interview. So first of all, there have been some major protests happening in India since a female doctor was brutally raped and murdered while she was laying down to rest during a night shift in a hospital in India on August 9th in Calcutta. On Tuesday, thousands of student protesters marched in the streets and police responded by using water cannons and tear gas against them. The country's Supreme Court had to step in this case because law enforcement has been criticized for the slow response and for allegedly covering up what happened. The court also ordered a task force to be set up to create recommendations for safety protocols in workplaces. These recent protests are a response to this specific horrific crime, but they are also about the broader prevalence of gender-based violence in India. We spoke with Rana Ayub, a great friend of this show, an Indian journalist and opinion columnist at the Washington Post, to get some more context. Here's a clip from that conversation.
But what happens in India is that we have this flash in the pan moment where one rape happens and everybody's like, okay, we have to protest. And then suddenly every rape story is covered. But what we do not realize is there is a rape in this country every 18 minutes. Every 18 minutes, one rape happens, right? As we talk, as this doctor was raped, For the next 4 days, there were reports of two children in Bombay being sexually assaulted. There was a story of a 14-year-old lower caste girl being raped in a state in a northern state of India. There was a story of a young woman going to report her rape, but the cops refused to report to accept the case, and she died by suicide. When somebody says India is a rape capital, the people are not talking about it. We take offense saying, but you are attacking the credibility of this country. You're attacking the sovereignty of India, not realizing that patriarchy, the inherent patriarchy in our popular culture, the inherent patriarchy in our films, in our dramas, in our policing, in our political landscape, women are not stakeholders, right? So when something like this happens, political parties start playing this blame game. The Congress, the opposition party will blame the BJP, the BJP will blame the Congress, and that's it. But nobody will talk about how do we end this systemic violence against women, that women, again, in this country do not feel safe to step outside. We are not safe.
Ron also pointed out in our conversation that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi actually promised major reforms back in 2012 and rode, you know, a wave of anger about violence towards women after that horrific, infamous gang rape in 2012 when he was elected. But statistically, things have only gotten worse since then, despite the government ushering in tougher sentences. According to the National Crime Records Bureau in India, there are more than 30,000 rape cases per year. Ben, the question I had is, do you think that this is the kind of thing that has been or should be raised by like U.S. officials in meetings, or, you know, like could be Joe Biden to Modi, but also like Tony Blinken or others, or like specialists in the State Department, just kind of like generally pressuring elected officials to hold people more accountable? Because it's clear that they're not taking seriously the pressure they feel internally, at least yet.
I think the thing, you know, I'm not sure that the bilateral kind of pressure makes the difference on this as much as part of what the U.S. government can do at its best is, you know, we have an office, an ambassador focused on gender equality at the State Department, do a lot around the world on these issues. Part of what you want to do is globalize this conversation. What can everybody be doing to strengthen safeguards against rape and sexual assault and against gender-based violence, and kind of bring India into conversations on a multilateral basis about like how do you toughen laws, how do you like change culture, how do you, you know, allow for better reporting, all the kinds of things that might address this. But I do think it's worth Americans speaking to this in the relationship with India. But within India itself, like part of what you have to get at, and I don't claim to be the expert on this, and Rana captured it far better than I could, but you know, some of this is just, you know, deeply embedded cultural norms that need to evolve like they do everywhere. But some of this is also like you unleash a certain brand of, you know, pretty male-dominated Hindu nationalism, you know? Yeah. And it does kind of like create cultures of impunity around powerful people, or the justice system, you know, is more focused on Muslims than Hindus. And once you just start to kind of create that kind of dynamic, it can manifest itself. And look, it's what we see here, right? Like Trump is a MAGA. Guess who suffers under that a lot? Women, you know, because there's a kind of patriarchal attitude that, you know, leads to the Dobbs decision, that leads to, you know, suddenly IVF is being targeted. It's the same thing there, right? Like if this kind of right-wing nationalism creates the wrong environment to fix the problem.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you to Rana for talking to us for this. And everyone should follow her work. She's one of the best journalists out there covering Modi and all things happening in India. Finally, Ben, World War II can feel like ancient history these days. But in reality, it wasn't that long ago, right? You know?
Yeah.
40s. Which is probably why some people in London were a little weirded out the other day when a German warship was spotted cruising down the River Thames while blasting the Imperial March from Star Wars. The Darth Vader song. Let's take a listen. So I believe this was just a person who spotted this like German destroyer rolling into their city, playing that song. So the ship was in the area for training. It stopped in London for a routine supply stop. After this video went viral, the German Navy released a statement on the music choice saying, quote, "The commander can choose the music freely. The choice of music has no deeper message." Really?
Do we really?
Are we sure? Do we buy that?
So I actually watched, not anticipation of the segment, last night I watched Return of the Jedi with my daughter.
Nice. Ella, how's she like it?
She loves it. So we've done, Ella and I have now done the first, you know, first three, which I guess are 4 through 7. She liked the Ewoks in particular, if people remember that.
How do you not?
But, oh.
Ewok Village? Yeah, Ewok. Do you have that toy?
And that thing where you can, yes, I had all the, I was explaining last night, I had the robots with like the tall legs and you could shoot, you know, the.
What are they called?
Yeah.
The nerds are going to hate us for not knowing that.
We'll come. I know. We better on Pavel Bure. But what I will say is, you forget that all the kind of white dudes that are like running the Death Star in Return of the Jedi, and they're Nazis. Like they're clearly modeled on Nazis.
Yes.
Like they look like Nazis. They're wearing kind of Nazi adjacent uniforms. The whole, you know, goose stepping Empire thing. Like clearly, the Empire was so. I don't know, not reading the deeper meaning, like it just feels like a little too close to comfort.
Yeah, don't have to read that deep, pal.
Yeah.
You're talking about these things? The AT,
those
AT
guys,
Walker?
Those guys. Yeah, the AT Walker.
All-terrain armor now, transport.
Yeah, those things are badass. And the Ewoks get control of one of those and quickly wipe out the Empire, you know.
Yeah, those things are just smoking Ewoks left and right. And then the Ewoks are like, what if we wrap string around their legs?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's pretty simple.
Yeah, and use like some slingshots, yeah. But that's, you know, if I was a German, I actually would... You know, there's a different soundtrack you could test out next time.
German's not always known for the sense of humor. Commander was having a good laugh as he cruised into London. Okay, that's the end of the news section for this very slap-happy show. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear my interview with Senator Peter Welch from Vermont. We talk about Gaza. We talk about Ukraine. We talk about Kamala Harris's campaign. Lots of good stuff. Oh, we also talk about seeing Tim Walz, the vice presidential nominee, in the gym. And what that was like. So stick around for that. Joining me today is Vermont Senator Peter Welch. Senator, it's great to see you again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
We were just chatting about all things Woodstock, Vermont, because my mom spends a lot of time up there. I will not make the listeners hear all about Shackleton Thomas and all the other great stores in the region. But if you have a chance to go to Vermont, you can go in the winter, you can ski, go in the summer. It's beautiful. I mean, really go anytime. It's a great state.
Well, that's right. So come on up. We'll give you a little nice Vermont welcome. Yeah, me and Bernie will give you some maple syrup.
Yeah, nice Vermont welcome, which means getting beeped at if you have a New York or Massachusetts license plate sometimes in my experience. But I digress. Senator, I just want to start by saying I have appreciated for nearly a year now your leadership in the Senate when it comes to trying to end the war in Gaza. You've been calling for a ceasefire since, I think, November of last year. You were one of just a handful of senators who actually voted against sending additional military aid to Israel as part of this broader package. But, you know, you and Bernie spoke out very strongly against your concerns. Unfortunately, you know, despite your efforts, 10 months into this war, it's still raging on. And the Biden administration's approach still seems to be send Bibi Netanyahu and the Israeli military what they ask for, and then I guess hope on the side we can cut a ceasefire deal. Have you been able to talk directly with President Biden or his team about maybe changing this approach or trying to force Netanyahu to change course by withholding arms or other diplomatic pressure?
No, I haven't talked to him personally. But, you know, the bottom line here is that all of the fears that we had with the Netanyahu approach to this horrible event of October 7th came true. And it's basically scorched earth, a massive bombing, 2,000-pound bombs on apartment buildings where you're thinking maybe there's a Hamas person on the second floor and you blow up the entire building. And, you know, Gaza, the suffering there is immense. And the search for the hostages continues. Good news today, one hostage has been returned alive and well. But, you know, what I think the basic question for us, the U.S., is whether we're going to use our leverage. I mean, what I find so difficult is that the policies we enunciate, which is a two-state solution, which is in opposition to more settlements in the West Bank, which is in service of the dignity of Palestinians and the security of Israel. We assert these as policies, but then essentially bend to whatever it is Netanyahu decides to do. And the challenge we have, and I actually think it's a real challenge that Israel has, is they've got a very extreme right-wing government that, in fact, people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich want a one-state solution, which is to say driving Palestinians out. And you're seeing that with their aggressive efforts in the West Bank, and you're seeing it with their overall policy. So at a certain point, the administration, or hopefully the Harris administration, is going to have to use the leverage we have to stand up to Netanyahu rather than allow him to continue to disregard our aspirations. So that's, I think, the question down the road that hopefully the Harris administration is going to face, and I hope will use the leverage that it has.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the Harris administration and what she should do, but one more question on Congress. I mean, I was struck by the fact that back in March, you had this amazing speech from Senator Schumer where he was basically calling on Netanyahu to step down, calling him illegitimate. And then a few months later, he joined with Republicans to extend an invitation to Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress. And I was wondering how you understand that seeming contradiction, if that was politics or I don't know.
I think Schumer got jammed a bit by the speaker, you know, and this has gotten very partisan. So when we're talking about what happened with the invitation, it has very little to do with our policy towards Israel. But the speaker, Mike Johnson, is using the Israeli issue to try to stick it to Democrats and present this as a partisan issue. And in fact, the overall question is, how do we assure Israel's right to be a democratic Jewish state when the policies that are being pursued by Netanyahu are extremely violent and over the top, and where the settlement expansion is doing more and more to undercut any kind of credibility for Israel in their position. And what's happened here is that Israel's standing in the world has really been diminished, and that's a threat to its own security, not to mention that you've got an enormous risk of escalation. So, you know, my preference would be that, that Senator Schumer didn't extend the invitation, but I get it. And in fact, you saw a number of people, myself included, Bernie included, that didn't go to the speech, not because we didn't want to hear from an Israeli leader, but we saw how essentially Netanyahu just stokes the partisan flames and is very insulting to the American people, in my view.
Yeah. You mentioned your hopes for Vice President Harris's campaign. I mean, I assume that for the next few months, President Biden is going to personally manage all things foreign policy until the last minutes of his presidency, especially the Netanyahu account, given how he's approached it to date. So I think those listening and hoping that Kamala Harris, now ascending to the top of the ticket, can sort of change current policy are probably out of luck. But I think you're right. I mean, I'd love to hear her signal or explain how things would be different if she's elected. Do you have any recommendations for how she should do that?
Well, it's what I'm talking about now. Well, first of all, in the campaign, here's the reality in my view. We have to beat Trump. We have to beat Trump and keep him out of the White House. Netanyahu is rooting for Trump. Yeah. Putin is rooting for Trump. And the other reality is that the American people, I do not believe, are going to decide this race on the basis of foreign policy. It's going to be basis of economics. You know, folks are freaked out about their kids not being able to afford a house, no matter how hard they work. And in a two-partner family, even both of them have good jobs, a house is still out of reach. Childcare, family leave, the cost of healthcare, even with Obamacare, is really escalating beyond reach, not just for individuals, but for employers who are trying to have employer-sponsored healthcare. So I think this campaign is really going to be about Harris's ability to show that she cares about the middle-class economic struggles, and those are real. And the foreign policy questions that are incredibly important, like what's going on in Gaza, in Israel, I don't think will be determining factors in this race. And you only have one president at a time. And of course, she's running as the vice president of the sitting president. So the policy is going to be determined much more by, obviously, by the president. I think what Harris did manage to do, you know, and it's understandable in the political context, is she signaled what has been traditional support for Israel, but not defining that Israel as Netanyahu. But she gave a very significant acknowledgement of the unspeakable suffering that Palestinians are experiencing as a result of the Netanyahu policy. So bottom line here, she's got to focus on what does it take to win. Economic issues, I think, have to be front and center. And I hope she can signal that she's going to turn the page on just this, I think, excessive deference to Netanyahu. My advice to her would be what my advice has been all along. We are for a democratic, independent state of Israel, and we're for a democratic, independent state of Palestine. But in order to get that, we have to use our leverage because the current Israeli government does not share those goals. That's bottom line. So at a certain point, Netanyahu can't just disregard everything we are advocating and have us accommodate everything he's doing. We've got to call the question.
Yeah. There were a lot of delegates at the DNC, many of them from the uncommitted movement, which was, you know, people who voted uncommitted in the primary to signal anger at President Biden's Gaza policy. They wanted a Palestinian speaker to be allowed to speak at the DNC. That didn't happen. Do you think that was a mistake?
Well, I would have supported a Palestinian speaker. I really would. But let me be clear. And I'm just horrified at what is happening. It's 40,000 people. When we talked, you know, the last time, however many months ago, it was in the thousands. But now it's like 40,000 in Gaza has been destroyed. And Netanyahu shows no signs of changing or adjusting his policy in any way. So there's a very compelling reason to allow those who are experiencing the suffering to speak out and express it. So I'm very empathetic with that goal, and I appreciate folks out on the street, but which, by the way, I was out in the street in that very same convention in 1968 when the issue was the Vietnam War.
Wow.
That was in my past. But
were you running for the cops? Like, what was that like?
Well, I was. I mean, I had dropped out of college then, and I was working in the west side of Chicago doing civil rights work with a Martin Luther King Southern Christian Leadership affiliated organization. It was really about housing discrimination. But, you know, that was an incredible time in our country. Bobby Kennedy had just been assassinated in June. Martin Luther King had recently been assassinated, the memory of JFK being assassinated. And of course, the Vietnam War was such an extraordinarily divisive issue where my generation, I had friends I went to in high school that didn't go to college, didn't get a deferment, and they went to Vietnam and some of them died and some of them came back with wicked injuries. So it was just a fiercely divided situation. So in that protest, I was there. I didn't get hit, fortunately, but I did. I was in the path of the gas that they were. You know, it was awful. I mean, it was a police riot unleashed by Mayor Daley. But you know, here's where I think all of us have to really say what's going to happen in the next 70 days plus a few, and that is the American people are going to decide who's the president. And my focus will be, what do we need to do to win, as opposed to what do we need to do because it's a very important issue to us. If that helps us to win, I'm for it. If it compromises our ability to win, I'm not. Because I think the difference between Trump and Harris is night and day. It's night and day on Israel and our prospects to influence her policy and her approach and give her support to stand up to Netanyahu. But it's night and day on Ukraine and Putin and just the Democratic government. So I do think that she's got to focus on the economy because people have this weird, in my view, memory of things being better during the Trump years, at least according to some polls. They weren't, in my view. And he doesn't have any plans to do anything that's at all constructive other than more tax cuts for very wealthy people. So I think Harris did an extremely good job getting us started. And by the way, and this is an interesting contrast between this convention in 68. You know, I was in college then, dropped out, as I said, but there was an enormous sense of despair among a lot of my classmates and my generation at how unresponsive the political system was. I mean, Vietnam was outrageous. That was the American policy, to go to war and be killing these Vietnamese, and the damage we did there and the suffering we inflicted on young people here and the cynicism that was created, it was unspeakable. We couldn't get the politicians to pay any attention and listen. Fast forward, we have this situation where President Biden had that bad debate where a lot of folks thought, you know what, we really appreciate what you've done. You've been a great president, but we don't think we can win if you're continuing as our candidate. He responded. The political system responded. So it actually gives me some hope. There was responsiveness there. So now, I was among those who really did think it was important for the president to step aside so that we had a shot at winning. And it was extraordinary, the energy that was unleashed. And of course, Kamala Harris was there to essentially mobilize that. And now we've got to harness it so that every day is about doing, you know, what Tim Walz was saying, make that phone call, get that $5 contribution, knock on that door. So there is a responsiveness that I see in this election that was denied us in the 68 election.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, you should know, I think you were the very first U.S. senator to call on President Biden to step aside. So thank you for that and stepping up when people needed to hear that message from senior members of the party, elected officials. Last question on Gaza, and I do want to ask about Ukraine. I mean, assuming I'm with you that Donald Trump would be a disaster for Gaza, Kamala Harris, I have no doubt, would be better, although she is some sort of gaps, and we don't necessarily know what her plan would be, understandably, in some ways. Peter Beinart wrote a piece in the New York Times where he argued that if elected president, Vice President Harris should take a very Vermont approach to Gaza by saying she will enforce current law, the Leahy Law, named after former Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, which basically prohibits the U.S. from assisting units of a military or a security force that commits gross violations of human rights. The Leahy Law has been used many times, but it's never been applied to Israel. Do you think that would be an approach that makes sense?
Well, I do. I think that's a really good place to start. If we have a law, enforce the law. And by the way, the Leahy Law is an example, okay? But the War Crimes Act is also an example. There are standards that apply, and the Department of Justice has jurisdiction over the war crimes. And of course, State Department has jurisdiction over the Leahy Law. So when we talk about enforcing the law, yes, the Leahy Law, but also some of the war crimes law that is being enforced by justice towards Russia and Ukraine. We should be doing that where there are credible reports like the World Central Kitchen killing, like other reports about Israeli units doing things that are not at all justified, even in under the laws of war. So Beinart's got, I think, a very good point. And that's kind of what I'm talking about with a Harris administration that basically stands up for our principles, and they're enunciated in those. The Leahy Law is a good example. Enforce it. Then you're not, you know, it's just, you can't violate the Leahy Law, period.
Right.
Enforce the War Crimes Act. Enforce our long-held position during Republicans and Democrats that you can't have settlements in the West Bank. And of course, the violence in the West Bank is escalating enormously. And a lot of the right-wing elements of the Netanyahu government are using as a cover the war in Gaza, essentially to start perpetrating violence and land seizures in the West Bank. So I think that would start sending a signal that the U.S. is serious about what we say we're serious about, and we're not just going to capitulate constantly to whatever Netanyahu does. We can't trust the guy. I mean, so at a certain point, you've got to call the question.
Agreed with that. Switching gears to Ukraine, Ukrainian officials have been and remain incredibly frustrated by restrictions put in place by the Biden administration about how U.S. military aid to Ukraine can be used. Specifically, they want to be allowed to hit targets across the border in Russia, the concern being that, you know, essentially the Russian military has a safe space from which to launch glide bombs and other munitions onto them, and they can't respond and take those military units out. Do you think that the Biden's restrictions are appropriate? Is it time to change course? Like, how are you viewing this these days?
We should give more latitude to Ukraine to strike military targets in Russia, not civilian targets, okay? But where we have good intelligence that some of those glide bombs are being launched from location A, we should be, the Ukrainians should be given the green light to use what they have, including things we've given them, to take out that offensive asset that is being used against their defenseless people. So focus on the military targets. But yes, I think it's really important for us to give that latitude to Ukraine.
One other question for you. Governor Tim Walz just got shot out of a presidential campaign cannon. He wasn't when he was selected to be Kamala Harris's vice presidential nominee. Most Americans had not heard of him until a few weeks ago. You served with him in Congress. Did you work with him much? Did you know him? What can you tell us about him?
Oh, God. You know what? He was my classmate. And when you go to Congress, the people you know the best and know the longest and experience share the most experiences with are your classmates. And he and I were elected in 06. And we were on the Agriculture Committee together. So I worked a lot with him on that. He was on the Veteran Affairs Committee and I wasn't. But I supported him when he first ran to be ranking member. And I made a speech on his behalf in the Steering and Policy Committee. And he didn't get it that time because he wasn't the most senior. There was one person ahead of him, but he was clearly the best, the command sergeant major. And everything you see about Walz, that's what we saw. I mean, he was very, very popular and kind of just liked person. You know, he didn't take himself as a big deal, but he worked as hard or harder than anybody else. You know, and he's so unassuming. Not that people want to hear about the gym, but we were in the same row and he'd come in and he was determined to lose a few pounds and he would go out and run no matter what the weather. But he went back to his National Guard days. He wanted to get into his running stuff quick and get back into his suit clothes fast. So he would just take his tie down halfway, unbutton the top couple of buttons of his shirt, and then pull off his dress shirt like it was a T-shirt. And he'd be out the door and running. But I really, really think he's a breath of fresh air in politics, and his lack of pretense, but his energy, his affection for his family and the people he serves, that's real. The other thing, by the way, there's two things that Kamala Harris did that really have given me a lot of confidence that she's in charge of her campaign. First, she picked Walz. And you know that the pollsters and the consultants were probably saying, well, you got to go with Shapiro because he's Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. A lot of logic to that. He's a compelling guy. But she clearly saw something in Walz that probably didn't show up on the polling and his ability to connect to everyday Americans. And then the second thing that I thought was really terrific, she described him as a middle-class kid who grew up in Nebraska, very modest, and she as a middle-class little girl who grew up in Oakland. So it's an inclusive approach that sometimes the Democrats aren't good at, and we've got to be focusing on everybody who is struggling to try to make ends meet in an economy that's really tough if you're trying to buy a home or even rent now. The rents have gone so way up. So I think Tim is going to be a good partner in that effort, and I think that's really where the campaign is going to be won, their effectiveness.
I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt the same way. I felt energized and excited by him being named. I actually had a chance to interview him in February And we spent 5 or 10 minutes talking about football. He was a defensive coordinator, so I pressed him on what defense he ran. You ever bring him to Vermont, like show him what a real cow looks like?
Yeah, no, I should do. You know, he's a guy in demand right now. I'm not sure we'll get him in a state where it's looking pretty good for the Harris-Walls ticket, but okay. Maybe afterwards.
Yeah, well, listen, I think you should get him up there. You know, you're like, oh, you think it's cold Minnesota, pal? Like, let's go up to Killington or something. Senator, thank you so much for doing the show. And thank you again for just being a leader on all things Gaza for a very long time, especially when it was not as clear that was the right path.
Thank you. No, and I appreciate your leadership on that story. It's absolutely appalling. We should not be part of this.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Senator Welch for joining the show. And thanks to you guys, the listeners.
Thanks to Pavel Bure for having a quick fucking set of wrists, you know.
And that guy had, he
wrist
could just
shot
accelerate.
Like nothing else, yeah.
Very handsome, too. Good looking hockey player. I was more of a Jeremy Roenick guy.
I feel like between Oasis and Pavel Bure, we were kind of dating ourselves a little
kind
too
of.
Hard. Yeah.
I mean, kind of. Yeah, big time. All right, that's it. Talk to you soon. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. If you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Ilona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick and engineered by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Phoebe Bradford, William Jones, Kirill Palaviv, and Molly Lobel, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld. It was not long ago that two old, unpopular men were running for the world's most important job. Since 1992, every American president bar one has been a white man born in the 1940s. If Trump wins, that run could span 36 years. This cohort was born with aces in their pockets, and yet their last act in politics nearly saw the two main parties accusing each other of wrecking American democracy. As the boomers near the end of their political journey, John Prideaux sets out to make sense of their inheritance and their legacy. Search BOOM from The Economist wherever you listen to your podcasts, and unlock all episodes by subscribing to Economist Podcast Plus.